The Role of Faith, Part 3, the 20th talk in a series titled Biblical Philosophy, the Message and Worldview of the Bible, was presented by Jack Crabtree on January 20, 2013 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A recorder malfunction resulted in the loss of a few minutes of this talk. Three gaps are indicated in the recording. The handout mentioned in this talk is handout number 12 in this series.
We've been talking about faith, and I've argued that the perspective that you find more typically in Christian culture is that because the Bible teaches that it seems to teach rather straightforwardly, if you believe, you will be saved. If you don't believe, you won't be saved. If you believe in Jesus, you'll have eternal life. If you don't believe in Jesus, you will be condemned. And that seems fairly straightforward in the teaching of the Bible. So we haven't really thought all that deeply about why does the New Testament say that? Why does it teach that? And what underlies that? And because we haven't thought about that, we just kind of leave it at that level of if you believe, you'll be saved. If you don't believe, you won't be saved. And we sort of have the underlying assumption that it's an intellectual achievement. It's because you have come to the point of understanding and embracing what the gospel is. It's that mental act of embracing what the gospel says that saves you. And what I've been arguing is I don't really think that's what Jesus and the apostles are getting at. Rather, what they're getting at is there are two kinds of people in the world. Starts off being one kind of person in the world. We're born into this world. We are morally depraved. We are bent. We are broken. Morally, we are not what we ought to be. We are not the kind of human being that God intended humanity to be. And not only are we broken in this way, but we are in rebellion against God and everything that God stands for. We're in rebellion against our Creator, but we're in rebellion against His values. We're in rebellion against His project. Rebellion against His purposes for our lives and history. So, as such, we deserve condemnation. But there's another kind of person that comes into being. And that person comes into being, as Jesus put it in John 3, when we are born from above. When there's this divine invasion into our lives. God, without our permission, invades our lives and begins to transform our hearts, our insides. And as He transforms our insides, this rebel that used to be hardened against God and the things of God begins to become receptive. Whatever God wants, I want. Whatever God says is true, I accept as true. We become, instead of negative and hostile toward God, we become positive and open and receptive to God and the things of God. The biblical picture, the New Testament picture is, that's the person who's going to receive mercy from God. And it is mercy that the person is receiving. It's not like we have done anything by becoming finally receptive to God to kind of undo our depravity and our moral unworthiness. No, we're still very morally unworthy, but we are fit for mercy now. We are the kind of person that it is not a moral outrage if God were to extend mercy to us. So when the Bible talks about believing in Jesus or believing in the gospel, believing in Jesus is the tip of a much larger iceberg. And the iceberg that's happening is what's happening in the heart of a human being. We are being utterly and completely reoriented from our hostility to God toward our receptivity to God. And believing the truth of the gospel is not the only, but it's one important symptom of that transformation taking place inside of us. Okay, so what does that mean? What are the implications of that? The implications of that are, they go in a couple of directions. On the one hand, unlike so much of Christian culture that absolutizes belief in Jesus and says, if you don't believe in Jesus, you're going to go to condemnation. And if you have never heard of Jesus, I guess that's too bad, huh? That you're going to be condemned for never hearing in Jesus. So because we absolutize it so much, we believe that to be biblical and to be faithful to the biblical teaching, we're going to have to take a hard line there and insist that God can't save anybody unless they believe in Jesus because the Bible says so. And my contention is, no, that's not what the Bible's saying. Because you have a long list of people throughout the Bible who have never believed in Jesus, who are nevertheless trotted out and offered to us as examples of the kind of faith we need to have. Enoch, Abel before that, Abel, Enoch, Noah, for that matter, Abraham, who's the father of our faith, did not believe in Jesus. Well, how is it that God can save him, but he can't save us without believing in Jesus? Because it's not about the act of believing in Jesus. It's about the significance and the meaning of believing in Jesus. And what's the significance and the meaning? My belief in Jesus represents a transformation of me on the inside where God has turned me into a human being who's fit for God's mercy. If he does it in the context of knowledge of Jesus and the gospel, then how is that openness and receptivity to God going to manifest itself? I won't deny the gospel. I won't refuse to believe it. I will be open to it. If it happens in some other context where I don't even know anything about Jesus, it's going to manifest itself differently. But what every child of God has in common is this inward openness and receptivity to God and the things of God. That's what's critical, and that's what's important. So one important implication is that we shouldn't take the New Testament and absolutize belief in Jesus as the one and only one way you can be saved. That's not true. You can be saved however God wants to save you, but the thing that will always be true is he's saving you and indicating the fact that he's saving you by transforming your insides. That's what all children of God have in common. Then on the other hand, and that's the part we didn't get to last week, on the other hand, everyone who believes in Jesus is not necessarily going to be saved. That also follows because, as we've talked about in the last couple of weeks, there's two ways to believe, and there's two ways to believe in Jesus. I can believe in Jesus because I've confronted the truth. I've been exposed to the facts about Jesus and who he is and what he did, the teaching about him, and so on. And I'm not allergic to it. I don't deny it. I don't refuse it. I'm not defiant toward God and his truth. And for that reason, those facts begin to sink in and speak for themselves. And I wake up one day and I realize it's the truth. How can I not believe it? I've got to believe this. How can I not? In that process, it's an ordinary intelligent process of an intelligent human being confronting facts and information and data and arguments and being persuaded by them. And the reason I can be persuaded by them is I don't have this other sinful rebellion against God sabotaging the process and preventing me from just letting the truth be the truth. But there's another way that we can believe in Jesus, and that is because there's some kind of payoff to us. You know, remember we talked a couple weeks ago about how frequently human beings believe not because it's rational, not because it's the intelligent thing to do, but for other psycho-emotional or, for that matter, social reasons. There's something else that I'm going to get out of it. And that can be a wide variety of things. I can have a community, a built-in community. Once we invented churches, now I have a whole society that I can be a member of, and I can be accepted, and I can have relationships, and I can socialize with people who share the same values and so on. That's very comfortable. That's very satisfying. Does it mean you're going to get eternal life? Not necessarily. Maybe we are getting our reward in full if we are getting out of church what church has to offer. There can be economic benefit, there can be political benefit, there can be social benefit of various kinds. A church can be a little empire. If you want to be an emperor, there's an opportunity for you. There's job openings to be an emperor of a little empire. There's all kinds of things that might be attractive to our humanity, innocently enough, or to our evil, nefariously enough. You know, there's all kinds of things that may attract me to embracing Christianity. And none of those are indicative of the fact that I'm a child of God. One and only one thing would be indicative that I'm a child of God. It's because I believe because I'm open. I believe because I'm receptive. I believe because I want to be rightly related to God and what God is doing in the world, and the gospel is it. And so that's what I want. That's what I want to line up with. Now, question came up at the end of last week that I want to address. The question was, am I saying that you have to be intelligent to be saved? Now, it's ironic because the fact of the matter is my whole point in this series is to say exactly the opposite of that. No, you don't have to be intelligent to be saved. Why? Because it's not about what you do with your mind, primarily. I mean, I'm going to have an on the other hand part in a second, but on the one hand, it's not what you do with your mind that counts. It's what's happening in your inner being, your will, your passions, your heart, your love, and so on. What is that directed toward? What is that oriented toward? Is it oriented toward God and the things of God, or is it in rebellion, in defiance of God and the things of God? If it's open to God, however that manifests itself, that's God's business. But to be open to God is to be a child of God, to be receptive to Him and the things of God. Now, a person can be receptive to God and have terrible theology. A person can be receptive to God and not know the first thing about how to open the Bible and read it. A person can be open to God and not even know about Jesus. That's what I've been arguing, you know. You don't even have to believe in Jesus necessarily. Enoch didn't believe in Jesus. So it depends on my time and place in history, but it also depends upon my native intellectual ability, how much my mind is going to be a part of my love of God. If I am retarded mentally, if for some reason I just don't have a lot of native horsepower intellectually, that's no obstacle to God invading a person's life and softening their innate rebellion against God and making them a child of God. They're simply going to manifest that the way they are going to manifest that. So I hope that's clear. Some of the wisest people in the world are the simplest people in the world. No intellectual sophistication at all. May not be all that intelligent to start with, and in any case, they're not really, they never did get a highfalutin education. You know, whatever education they got was pretty rudimentary and pretty simple, and There's nothing really particularly intellectually sophisticated about them. But they are wise and godly men and women. They care. They care about what's good. They care about God. They care about what God is doing in the world. All that stuff is vitally important to them. And as best they can grasp it and understand it, that's the important thing in their life. They are children of God. And their wisdom comes from the fact that they are rightly related to God and rightly oriented to God. Some of the most intelligent Christians in the world are some of the most unbelieving Christians in the world. There's no correlation between being intelligent and having true faith and true belief. And in fact, being highly intelligent can be very dangerous because it gives you all that horsepower that you can use to rationalize your unbelief if you choose to. And many, many do. That's the way they go. So quite the contrary, the last thing I'm saying is that you have to be intelligent to be saved. God can save whoever he wants in whatever condition he finds them, in whatever state he finds them. On the one hand, and I'll open up to your questions here in a second. On the other hand, we do need to recognize that if we do have some semblance of intelligence, we need to use it. And maybe there was some of that coming out in what I was saying that maybe led to the impression that I was claiming you need to be intelligent. The problem is most of us get intimidated. We lack intellectual confidence. We lack that lack of confidence gets foisted on us by the people around us. So we begin to feel insecure, and when you begin to feel insecure, it's dangerous. You're right on the threshold of deciding, well, I've got to believe something, so I guess I'll believe this, and then I'm just going to take my stand there and I'm not going to move. And that's what I described 2 weeks ago as a religious commitment. We make a religious commitment to a doctrinal statement, a theological tradition, a Christian tradition, some kind of perspective about how to understand the faith. We make a religious commitment to it, and we make a religious commitment to a tradition that we're going to have a lot of support from socially. So we can tell ourselves from all the people around us, the people that make it plausible that this thing is true, well, they all think it's true, so I'm okay. I'm not that weird. I'm not that odd to believe this about the faith. Therefore, here I am, here I'm going to stay, and I'm done thinking about it. And that, I think, is irresponsible, maybe even unbelieving. I mean, that's God's call, not my call. But and I think probably in some people it's unbelieving, in other people it's just simply they're being disobedient and irresponsible. But if we do have the tools, we need to use those tools, employ those tools to pursue what's true. And to pursue what's true in the face of all those religious commitments that people, the church out there. I'm not to be just one more person who's religiously committed to this faith, understood in this particular way. No, the issue is, who is God? And what is he up to? And how is he doing it? And what, in other words, the issue is, what's true? And how can I be a child of God and not care about what's true? I think a child of God is necessarily a child of truth. And that if I refuse to be a child of truth, I think it calls into question whether I really am a child of God. So I am, do you have to be intelligent to be saved? No, but I do think we have to employ our whole lives to serve God and to follow him and to obey him and to know him. So we do have to use whatever semblance of intelligence we have and employ that to serve him more truly and to serve him more completely. So let me open it up for your questions. So I don't know if that clarified or made it worse or...
Does what you say is being a child of truth, does it mean being able to believe rationally that what Jesus and his teachings are is true? Or would you say in order to be a child of truth, you have to, whenever you have a chance, defend what you believe?
No, even when I talk about being a child of truth, I'm primarily talking about my heart attitude, not my intellectual state. There's no shame in not being able to intellectually defend against all criticism what I believe right now. All that means is, I guess I'm not prepared for that right now, am I? Well, there's no real shame in that. The shame, it comes when I'm confronted by the truth and I say, I can't handle the truth. You know, I don't want the truth. I would rather stay comfortably where I'm at than have to even ask myself the question whether that thing is true or not. Where would that be coming from? You see what I'm saying? Isn't rebuffing the possibility of knowing the truth, isn't that to rebuff God ultimately? I mean, why else would I be so resistant to letting the truth be true? But I would submit that probably many of you have confronted that in your interaction with other Christians. You know, you might get into a doctrinal or theological discussion and they say, I believe this. And you might propose an alternative. And if you begin having any kind of conversation about it at all, you might begin to make a case for why you look at it this way rather than this way. And I'll bet you've had the experience of people shutting down the conversation. We're done. I believe this. Shut up. I mean, there's nothing more to talk about. Really? No, I'm not saying to be open does not mean you get persuaded. You know, you don't prove that you're open by whoever comes along and proposes another alternative. You go, I guess I was wrong. You must be right. No, I'm not. You don't. Openness is being willing to hear and being willing to think and be willing to imagine your way out of your way of looking at it and imagine that maybe, what if I'm wrong? And what if there's a better way of looking at it? That I'm not afraid of that. I'm not opposed to that. I'm not hostile to that. I'm not stiff-arming that. I'm not rejecting that. I'm open to that. And then what I end up doing with contrary ideas depends on how well those contrary ideas stand up to scrutiny. You know, I can be totally open and end up realizing, I don't think your idea works. I don't think it's good. I don't think it reflects rightly what the Bible actually teaches. I don't have to persuade you of that, but I have to be persuaded in my own mind that I am doing the best I can to hear what the Bible is actually teaching and then conform my ideas to that. So my short answer to you, Michael, I think, is that it's not what I'm talking about in being a child of truth is not being someone who is really good at defending the truth. Rather, what's more important is that I'm someone who cares about the truth. It matters to me what's true and what's false when it comes to the gospel.
That completely answers my question.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, you've probably covered this before. And I just don't recall it, maybe, but in the alternative view, I need clarity on the need for Christ to die. If we go into the Old Testament and if we go to the garden, God dealt with the mankind in a certain way. And then throughout the Old Testament history, it seems that he provided a way for people to honor him and to approach him through the sacrifices and all the ceremonials. So it seems like, why wouldn't God just continue to deal with man that way and let us, when we die for our own sins instead of needing Christ to die inspires that question for me is when you say that there's not a need to believe in Jesus for salvation. If we have a heart for God, a true heart for God, then we are saved that way. So I'm just trying to put that in the puzzle together for me.
Okay. Some of you, if you haven't been here all along, Richard is taking us back a few weeks to an alternative view of the meaning of Jesus' death on the cross, and that's what's lying behind his question. Well, you know, for me, Richard, there's a prior question, and that is, and it took me a long time to realize this because, you know, as growing up in the church, it just automatically resonated with me. Well, Jesus had to die. So the question is, why did he need to die? And we have to answer that question. The prior question for me is that the right way to think about it? Did Jesus have to die? Did Jesus need to die in order for salvation to get worked out for us? Part of what I'm arguing in my alternate view is that, no, that's the wrong way to look at it. He didn't have to die. That's the way God did it. That was part of God's purposes. There's no way to God except through Jesus. He's the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through him. And I really think he means that quite absolutely. I don't think Enoch gets to the Father except through Jesus. I think that's right. So that's the way God did it. But did he have to do it that way? See, the minute we ask the question in that way, if we're wrong, if he didn't actually have to do it, then we're going to end up making up answers. We're going to make up an answer to why he had to do it. Well, what if he didn't have to do it? Maybe that's just the way he did it. And that's what I'm proposing, is that he didn't really have to. See, that in the traditional view of the atonement, God has a problem that God has to solve for God's sake. God is stuck. He wants to show mercy, but he can't show mercy. That's how we frame it traditionally. He wants to show mercy, but he can't show mercy. So Jesus is the solution to the puzzle of how he can show mercy, how he can show mercy without violating retributive justice. He can have his retributive justice and eat it too. That's what Jesus allows. And so because we're in that mindset, we're thinking that he had to have Jesus die because that's the only way he could solve his dilemma, solve his problem. But I notice, and here's homework, go and read your whole Bible from beginning to end, and I submit you will never, ever find any argument by any prophet or any apostle or Jesus himself making an argument that Jesus had to die. Just not there.
Okay, so if, let's see, God's the author, so this was going to be no surprise to him. He really didn't find himself in a predicament that, right. How am I going to solve this problem? Right. I never thought, man, would fall from my grace or whatever, you know.
Right.
So he apparently had a plan in the beginning to do this, and I don't know, I just have a hard time unlearning what I've been taught to open my mind, I guess, totally to how I can reconcile the atonement, I guess, to mm-hmm. put it in that sense, you know.
Well, what I'm proposing is a paradigm shift. You know, because what you and I were taught in the Christian church was a whole set of ideas that are all interconnected with each other. They all fit together. Intelligent people have constructed this, so they fit together coherently. They make sense. They seem to fall together, and so on. And whenever you make a paradigm shift, you have to go from a set of ideas that all fit together to a whole different set of ideas that all fit together with each other in a different kind of way. But the temptation is to always hold on to as much of this as we can. The problem is these ideas don't fit coherently with these ideas. You with me?
Exactly.
And so because they don't fit over here, but there's something in us, and I think it's a good thing in human beings that we're kind of conservative in that way, that we've believed for how many decades that this is true. Why would I just throw it away? So we don't do that readily. We don't do that easily. We have to finally come to a point of trying to understand this whole new paradigm on its own terms, within itself, and finally be willing to say, you know, this holds up enough that I'm willing to let go of this stuff. I'm willing to jump. And so what you're describing is the difficulty of that is just because you're an intelligent human being. And intelligent human beings don't just abandon a paradigm at the drop of a hat. They need to be persuaded there's someplace to go that really is reliable. And that can take some time.
Well, thanks for confirming I'm intelligent. So. But, I don't know. I'm just going to keep trying to see your side, and you know, I hope you understand that I really appreciate the work and effort that you put into trying to help us grasp new ideas, and so I'll work on that if you'll tolerate me.
And it's very important. The sign of open-mindedness is not agreeing with me. You understand that? I may be totally wrong, but the sign of open-mindedness is you're willing to come and show me what an idiot I am for believing what I'm believing. That you're willing to come back at me and show me the error of my ways, because truth matters to you.
A recorder malfunction occurred at this point.
I don't think he's talking about you don't have enough belief juice in you. You need more belief juice in you. I think little there is diminished, inadequate, defective, and then the faith, a synonym would be understanding. So what he's saying is, oh, you have faulty understanding, I think is what he's saying. Oh, you have inadequate set of truths. You know, you have a wrong perspective on the world. You don't know who God is. You don't know what God's relationship to his world, to his creation is. You don't know God's regard for you as a creature. You really don't understand that, do you? You have a defective understanding. So now I don't know if I can't tick off every place that's used, but the ones that come readily to mind, I think that's always what he means there. The faith the size of the mustard seed, there I think what he's doing is there must be a sense in which the disciples are tempted by a false understanding of how miracles happen. And you can imagine how that would be the case. I mean, in order to high jump 7 feet, I have to have strong muscles and Nike shoes, right? Something like that. There has to be some attribute that I have that allows me to do that. So maybe there's some attribute that Jesus has that allows him to be the center of these miracles that God is doing. And they may chalk it up to this thing called faith. And so I think what Jesus is saying is, no, you don't get it. Faith doesn't come in quantities. Even if it's genuine faith, if it's genuine understanding of who God is.
A recorder malfunction occurred at this point.
Why you think that Peter sank?
Why what?
Why did Peter? Peter says, "If that's really you, Lord, command me to come out."
And I don't think he did. I think that's the wrong way to read that passage. What the passage says is the waves rose, and in other words, I think he was being supported, but waves were coming up and maybe lapping over his, knees? And what it did is the increased depth of the water hitting him made him afraid. It's not that he was sinking, it's that he was afraid. And Jesus is rebuking him for his fear. I mean, dude, God's got you. What are you afraid of?
So is fear indicative of a lack of faith?
I'm sorry?
Is fear indicative of a lack of faith?
No, not all fear, but that...
A recorder malfunction occurred at this point.
I know what you're saying, but I think if you and I were to talk, mm-hmm. you and I would come to the conclusion that, yes, there's a very real sense in which we are exactly mm-hmm. what God intended us to be. And it seems difficult for somebody to... with a simple mind, and even people who are very smart and intelligent, to sort of grasp that God exists outside of this temporal construct, mm-hmm. and that the story is written, and He will have His way. He is having His way in my life. So that seems to me to be an example of a difficult truth. Does that mean it's a not important truth? And how does the simple-minded person, how important is it that they understand that and sort of step outside of the temporal existence?
Right. Great question. Ultimately, that God's going to have to answer that. I don't know. But I do think it's an important truth, even though difficult. But How does the typical Christian handle that? They have a very difficult time bringing into coherence the fact that God is sovereign and they are free. That's just very, very difficult. So what happens is they divide. Is God sovereign? Yes. Is God free? Yes. How do you put those together? I don't. They're both true. And they learn, this is part of their wisdom, I think, they learn when to bring this truth to the forefront and when to bring this truth to the forefront. When is the most relevant fact that I'm free? Well, when I'm making a hard choice about what I'm going to do with my life, the worst thing I can do is think, well, God is sovereign and I'll do whatever He's going to do, and then lead to some kind of fatalism. I don't have to make a choice. No, now is exactly when you need to make a choice. It's on you to define your existence by the choice you make right at this minute. So my freedom has to come to the forefront. When I'm frightened and afraid of history or the circumstances of my life, what is appropriate to bring to the forefront? God is totally in control. There ain't a single thing that's going to happen that is outside of His purposes, and His purposes are good. And this good God has control of your life, and He's not gonna destroy you. And that comes to the forefront. So I think simple people can nonetheless become very, very wise and understanding in being able to negotiate that tension and emphasize the right thing at the right time as they navigate their life. But where they lack the intellectual sophistication is to get, when someone starts pushing them, well, give me a picture of how both of those can be true at the same time. And you'll get either very, very anemic, feeble answers or an admission, I don't, I can't, I don't know how to put them together. And that, I think that's fine. But notice, it's not that we've abandoned the truth that's there. We just haven't put it together in a kind of intellectually, philosophically sophisticated way.
Well, the fact that you and I have been talking about this for 30 years,
exactly.
It's not too simple.
Yeah.
But I would certainly agree that, you know, if you look through the Bible, there are certainly what some people point out as contradictions between is it God, is it me, is it God, is it me? It's exactly, I think, as you said, because the writer, the author, the speaker is addressing a different kind of truth in the moment the relevant truth in the moment.
Exactly. Exactly right. Yeah. Okay, enough of that. Okay, just one last issue then. And I've kind of, on the last page and a half, I just bring up that issue of God's sovereignty versus us. We are God's creation. So when we believe, we are believing because God is creating us to be believers. We are shaped by Him. We are made by Him. We are created by Him. God determines everything that happens. We are characters in the story that He is telling, that He is creating. And we do what God creates us to do. But we do it as human beings, not as rocks or animals or some other kind of creature. We are human beings. And how do human beings, what kind of being and creature is a human being? A human being is a creature who makes free will choices. So God creates me to freely choose Him when He wants me to be a child of God, when he's making me to be a child of God. So again, this is in tension with the whole view of salvation that you find in so much of Christian culture, where the emphasis is placed on God has done everything that He can do, now it's up to you. So are you going to believe or are you not going to believe? And where are you going to get that belief? Well, you just got to come up with it. It's got to come from you, because what do you expect God to do everything? He's done enough. Now it's up to you to do the rest. No, we are His creations. Of course He does everything. If God doesn't do it, it can't exist. If God does not create it, it cannot be. If God does not will it, it cannot happen. That's the right way to understand God's relationship between created reality and Himself. So the same thing is true with respect to salvation. I believe because God has ordained that I belong to Him. And the way that's going to be played out is by, in my free choices, I am going to confront the truth of the gospel in Jesus, and I'm going to freely embrace that. And then just one last point. I haven't emphasized enough in wanting to define faith as not some kind of special energy that exists in me, but it's just the working of my mind, confronting truth and reality and deciding what to do with it. There is another dimension to faith in the New Testament that I haven't talked a lot about. I have another context, but not in the last couple weeks. There's more to faith than just believing that it's true, that Jesus is the Christ, that He will reign forever as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and that He died for our sins and so on. One could believe that that's true, but not stake their life on it. So the New Testament authors always assume that when they talk about belief, they don't mean casual, detached belief, where I give intellectual assent to it, but I don't really care about it. They are assuming that when you give intellectual assent to the fact that Jesus is the Christ, you care deeply about it enough that you're going to define your whole existence by that truth. That truth matters to you so much that from now on you're going to act in a way that's consistent with that being true, and everything about your life is going to act in consistency with that being true. If Jesus is who He says He is, then He's your Lord. If Jesus is who He says He is, then He'll be King forever. You will serve Him. If Jesus is who He says He is, then it's worth knowing Him. And we should love Him for what He has done heroically to save us and to make us part. I mean, and the list could go on and on. There are all kinds of implications of this truth that ought to transform and change everything about our lives. We live differently because we know that that's true. So that it, the New Testament writers always take that for granted. It's never casual intellectual assent. it's always existentially vital intellectual assent. My whole existence is going to be defined by my pursuit of the implications of that truth. I hope that's clear too. And then finally, I think I said this a couple weeks ago, but what fakes us out is that the New Testament is written at a particular time and place in history to a particular group of people. So when Jesus comes along to the Pharisees and says, unless you believe, you will not receive life, or in whatever form that he puts that, we have to keep in mind he's talking to the Pharisees. These are people who have seen his miracles. These are people who have stood there and heard his teaching. They don't lack information. If they don't believe, it's because they're resistant, not because they're ignorant. So when we take these statements in the New Testament and absolutize them, we are wrenching them out of their historical context and attributing meaning to them that Jesus never intended. Jesus didn't have in mind the Stone Age tribesmen in the jungles of the Philippines when he said, unless you believe, you will not have life. Because they're not being confronted by the same truths that the people standing right in front of him that he's talking to are being confronted with. These are the people who Jesus performs a miracle of casting out a demon, and they try to figure out, how did he do that without being the Son of God? No. I mean, that's who he's talking to. Unless you stop your stubborn resistance and allow the truth to penetrate into your being, you have no life. That's what he's saying. But he's not making an absolute claim about how absolutely critical to God is that you believe the right truths, because if you don't, you know, God would like to save you, but you just didn't get there. That's not at all, I think, what he's saying. And I think if the apostles were writing today, they would not put the same emphasis on belief in their writings that they did when they were writing. The reason they can put that kind of emphasis on it is in the first century, in the time of Jesus and the apostles, when you believed, what did it get you? Stoned to death, persecuted, ripped off, marginalized by society. There wasn't a lot of payoff. There was very, very little payoff for believing in Jesus. So the only reason you would believe in Jesus is you kind of didn't have a choice. Like, it's true. What am I supposed to do? It's true. It's true, and it's the most important truth in all of human existence. My eternal destiny comes from my responding rightly to this truth. So when you believe in the first century, it's a pretty good indication that it's the tip of a big iceberg in you, that something happening within you where the Spirit of God is tenderizing you to God and the things of God. Why else would you believe? But fast forward 300 years. Now why might you believe? Because the emperor is a Christian. The emperor is a Christian, and I want to be vice emperor. And he's not going to make me vice emperor if I'm a pagan, so I think I'll be a Christian. There's all kinds of payoff, all kinds of reasons now why you might believe, why you might embrace these truths that have nothing to do with you being sanctified by the Spirit of God in the core of your being. So if they were writing in 400 AD, I don't think the apostles would quite so straightforwardly and directly and simply say, we're justified because we believe. How could they? Because there's all kinds of people who weren't justified though they believed later in history. So we mustn't get faked out by the way in which the biblical authors express themselves. We have to get behind it. Why are you saying what you're saying? What underlies this? What are you really saying? Because otherwise we're going to absolutize things that shouldn't be absolutized. Okay, any other final comments or questions?
When you say belief, like believing in Jesus, what is the content of what a person is believing? if they're believing the right thing? What are they believing?
Well, I don't actually think ultimately there's any limit to the content. It's everything that is true and implied by the fact that Jesus is the Christ. At the center of what you're believing and from which everything flows, I think to believe in Jesus means to believe that he is who he claimed to be, that he's the Christ, the Son of the living God, that it's accepting that claim about him, that that's his status, that's how important he is. But then all kinds of things flow from that. And it depends on how knowledgeable and how sophisticated your understanding of the biblical teaching is, how many implications you might have embraced. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
This is probably going to be a little bit of a hard question, but with our concept of evangelism and what you're saying, and it seems as though from my own perspective, that it's that evangelism sort of makes or defines a specific point that somebody might become a believer. Mm-hmm. That's sort of what mm-hmm. we've learned. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Can you just explain maybe how the whole concept of evangelism, the biblical perspective of evangelism, works with what you're saying? Because I visualize that somebody would... if God has made them a child of his, they will be regardless of what I say.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway.
Okay, yeah, great question. We don't evangelize because if we don't tell them, God can't have them. That's not why we do it. We do it because it's good news. It's an act of love on our part. If I have been struck by this wonderful message about how God is going to give me mercy. He's not going to condemn me, even though I deserve it, but he's going to give me mercy. And let me tell you the story about how all that got worked out in history. He sent his son, and he died on the cross, and that son is going to be my advocate and my intercessor. And, I mean, hopefully we get infected with how exciting and how that news is, how good that story is. And the reason we would take it to others is because that potentially will be exciting and infective to them as well. Why would they not want to know that story? So we evangelize, I think, out of love. It's an act of love on my part to take this wonderful, wonderful news and let them in on it, because otherwise they may not know that.
But that's not really what's happened, is it? And it doesn't appear that evangelism is always stems from that.
You mean in our culture?
Yes.
No, you're right. I mean, what happened? And I don't know, this may be a relatively American phenomenon, going all the way back to Dwight Moody and before that, Finney, Charles Finney. They developed evangelism into a... You're going to sell people. What you want to do is close the deal, right? So, and we have a whole theology behind it. I mean, most people, when they think of being born again, their concept of being born again is a Jesus salesman came along and he closed the deal on me. And it was an intense, it's like being sold a mattress or a vacuum cleaner. It's an intense deal. And when finally you get past it and through it by closing the deal, there's so much relief that I'm born again. You know? I mean, I'm partly teasing, but not altogether. Finney literally developed what I would consider brainwashing techniques. So you came into an evangelistic service, and he had, you know, he had the mourner's bench, and... I don't remember now anymore what all of his devices were, but the way it came down to the evangelist in my childhood is what my son called the preacher voice. You know, where you shout something really loud, and then at some completely unpredictable and irrational place, you drop your voice down to a whisper like this, and then you start shouting again. I can't do it, but it's really a brainwashing technique. It makes you feel anxious. I mean, I just get anxious here thinking about it. It creates anxiety in you. And then, having created that anxiety in you, then I go, is the Spirit of God convicting you here tonight? I know the Spirit of God is at work. I know the Spirit of God is convicting you. Is he calling you to himself? Well, how can he not be? I mean, that you've been doing it to me for the past 15 minutes. How can he not be? You see what I'm saying? It's a psychological technique. The spirit may not even be 50 miles away from there. It's just somebody messing with your mind. So the climate, the culture of evangelism that has been so much a part of our Christian tradition is not evangelism. It's salesmanship and pulling out all the stops, using all the tricks to try to close the deal for people. And the problem, of course, is you can close the deal on someone and nothing happened. I mean, I remember the first time, I was in the second grade, the first time somebody closed the deal on me. And I remember very vividly and very distinctly the next day on the playground at school having this sort of inner dialogue. Jack, you weak, miserable little wimp. Why didn't you hold out? I got saved in spite of that, not because of the number that had been played on me. So, yeah, I think it's important to make a distinction between selling Jesus and proclaiming the good news of the gospel. Those are not the same thing. We can be a lot more... Did I in this context read this? Sorry if I'm repeating myself here, but I love this passage that in Paul. Paul's talking about his ministry of proclaiming the gospel. He says, this is in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, therefore, since we have this ministry as we receive mercy, we do not lose heart, but we have remembered the things hidden because of shame, not walking in craftiness or adulterating the word of God, but by the manifestation of truth, commending ourselves to every man's conscience in the sight of God. So what he's saying is, look, basically what I hear him saying is, I'm not selling the gospel. I'm not a snake oil salesman here. I'm not using craftiness and deceit and manipulation and what I'm doing is with integrity. I simply tell the truth and appeal to man's conscience to do with it what they will. That just an open proclamation of the truth. I don't sell anything. I don't peddle anything. And then he goes on, and even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing, in whose case the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelieving so that they might not see the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. So, given his theology, he doesn't feel any need to manipulate people or trick them into belief, because he knows that there are two kinds of people in the world. There are those people who... In whom God has pulled the veil away so that they can see, and those who remain veiled and are blinded. And if people don't respond to the truth of the gospel, it's because they're blinded, and no trick in the world, no manipulation in the world is going to solve that problem. You might get them to sign on the dotted line, but it doesn't make them a believer. They haven't really responded to the truth of the gospel when they do that. So what good have you done? And so knowing that that doesn't do any good, he simply speaks the truth, commending him by the manifestation of truth, commending ourselves to every man's conscience in the sight of God. That's evangelism.
Well, first I want to say thank you for being here, even though you're not feeling well.
Oh, thank you.
And I won't take too long. Kind of talking a little bit about the word or the experience of believing. I was in a conversation last week with somebody that I know real well, and they were saying that they had come more and more to believe that they indeed were like broken and that they couldn't escape their own corruption. And that's a change from years ago. And so in some ways they were telling me that they were more surrendered to that truth on some level, that, yeah, I think I'm a sinner. I can't get away from that experience. And then they said, but I feel like there's this thing about believing that some of the rest of you do, you being you and your other Christian friends, mm-hmm. that I don't, like, I don't have that. And so, yeah, like, so there's this thing about believing that I don't know how to do that. I can't remember exactly, but I think I might have said something about, well, I don't think there's a special thing that I do that you can't do. And I think I might have talked about something about like how God is responsive to anyone who earnestly is seeking him or desiring him, like knock and the door will be open, seek and you shall find, that kind of thing. Not quite as tritely as that, but and then we didn't finish the conversation. I know that we will get back to it, but I don't know if I've done a good enough job at laying out the context. But how would you speak to that that person dilemma?
There is that prayer that the man offers. I believe, help my unbelief. When Jesus is calling out faith on his part to heal his son, and he believes, but yet not really. And so he says to Jesus, I believe, help my unbelief. I think that's where we start, is we just get this kind of vague notion that there's something important here, and I would like to believe it, but if I'm, whatever reason, there's some kind of obstacle still, that I'd like to get past that obstacle, then that's just sort of an honest prayer I can offer to God. The only other thing I would think is that he may be working under a misconception that faith is a sudden, momentary, instantaneous thing of some kind. And we Christians are the ones who have advanced that notion, that the whole born-again experience is that you're not saved up to this point, and then you had a born-again experience, and now you're saved. But in real life, that's not how it happened to me. C.S. Lewis describes getting on the train at some station and getting off at another station, and he had gone from being an atheist to believing in God. And he's not quite sure how it happened, but, you know, when he got off the train, that realistically, I think that's how it happens for a lot of us. It's just we've been taking in a lot of information, a lot of data, and it just takes time to simmer. And sooner or later, all that simmering resolves itself into, oh, an insight. Oh, I get it. There is a God. God exists. And I think the same thing would be true with Jesus. We take it in, it simmers, and then over time, eventually, we've got, all of a sudden, we don't quite know where it came from, but we have this confidence that, oh, I get it. This is true. And enough confidence that we can act on and commit ourselves to it. So it's not a matter of, okay, I've got to do something today to make it happen today. It's just, well, if you think there's something there, pursue it and see where it goes, see where it leads. That there shouldn't be a compulsion to make it happen right now.